WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
When Jimmy Carter was elected president, Georgians rejoiced, a Southern man in the White House. Well, maybe his authority would encourage Northerners to stop giggling when they heard a Southern drawl. But on the other hand, Carter wasn't reelected. With me now is writer, humorist Roy Blunt, whose new book is called Crackers, a book of impressions and anecdotes about the South and the North and country music and President Carter, and a host of non-existent Carters who he made up for his book, like Velveeta Carter and Sister Muriel Oriola Carter and A. Don and E. Don Carter, the two-headed, four-armed, three-legged gospel-singing man. Crackers is published by Knopf. Roy Blunt is also a sports writer in his 1974 book about the Pittsburgh Steelers, about three bricks short of a load, has just come out in paperback. Roy Blunt, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
Should also mention that what brought him to Philadelphia was the Philadelphia Inquirer's Book and Author Luncheon, which was held yesterday in Philadelphia. What's your reaction to the election? The Georgian Jimmy Carter was not reelected. Do you think it was because of his accent?
Well, I think it, I mean, my theory about Carter is that I think that what keeps this country alive is barbaric yawps coming in from the hinterlands, and that Jimmy wasn't enough of a yawp. I mean, I think he tried to modify himself too much, and I think he might have been more vigorous if he'd been more of a cracker and more like he came from Georgia. And instead, he was always adjusting himself to everybody's taste, and I think that he failed not for the reasons you would expect a Georgia president to fail, but for opposite reasons. I mean, not out of narrow-mindedness or simple-mindedness, but out of complex-mindedness. I mean, he had too many facets, and he had no point of view. He was always trying to make himself respectable to everybody, and I was disappointed in him in that sense. But it seems to me that he's been replaced by much more of a, much more reactionary administration. I mean, what used to be wrong with Georgia politicians was that they were so reactionary. And but at least they had a lot of juice to them. And I think what we're getting now is the worst of both worlds, which is a reactionary bunch of Southern Republicans and Sun Belt Republicans, guys in white belts and white shoes, and Strom Thurmond and Larry McDonald bringing back the bringing back McCarthyism, maybe. I mean, both Strom Thurmond says he wants to bring back the the Senate Internal Security Committee, and Larry McDonald wants to bring back the House Internal Security Committee, which was the last name of the House Un-American Activities Committee. And so it seems to me that, the kind of politics that I grew up with in the South and wanted to get away from are the kind that have come in now that the Georgia president is out, which seems to me sort of ironic.
Why did you leave the South?
Well, I wanted to get up where people talked about books more, and where there was, I grew up sort of with an assumption that there was a civilized level somewhere, up in New York or somewhere where, on the level of the national media, where things made sense. You know, everybody was always pointing out in the national media that politicians in the South, for instance, were always using code words like states' rights, which actually meant hate and things like that. And, that was sort of embarrassing to be living in the part of the country where you could be talked to that way. So I wanted to get up where everybody understood the code words. Of course, the trouble is now that we've got Ronald Reagan using, we went to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and using words like states' rights. And so once I got up New York and in the East and got involved in the national media, I realized that there wasn't any level of perfect sophistication and knowledge, I think, which may be something that Jimmy Carter never really realized. He was always trying to appeal to some kind of abstract sense of the truth, and sort of trying to prove that he wasn't a cracker. And it seems to me that everybody has got a little cracker in them at every level, and that people are just as crazy in their own way who work for the New York Times as people who work in the drugstore back home. It's just, and once you accept that, you sort of grow up and don't mind so much that you're from Georgia and kind of enjoy sounding like you're from Georgia, even though it irritates people or something.
Is a cracker someone who's a regular on Hee Haw?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's the sort of standard image, or worse than that. I mean, either a regular on hee-haw or a brutal Southern deputy sheriff, or the people in the national public eye who are white people from the South tend to be stock figures, either sinister or dumb. I mean, there are no more Stepinfetchits and no more Shylocks in acceptable culture, but there are still these stock cracker figures that, you know, if you want somebody, you want to signal that somebody's a villain in a movie, you either make him a redneck or a homosexual or a German, you know, one of those, with a German accent or sort of mincing gait or Southern drawl tends to mean that it's a character you're not supposed to identify with. And nobody really sees anything wrong with that. You know, but it always, it affects the way you grow up. If all the role models you see in the, in movies and things who sound like you are bad guys or dumb guys. And I think that affected Jimmy Carter too much, maybe, because I think he didn't, he insisted on listening to classical music all the time, and
so you think that was compensation? All those journeys to the Kennedy Center and to the opera, compensation for being a Georgian.
Well, except but then when he tried to be down to earth, he wasn't very good at that either. But I think he wasn't. I mean, Jody Powell seems to be more of kind of the way Jody Powell talked. He told animal stories, used animal metaphors, and quoted the Bible in a kind of salty way. And whereas Carter was always the technocrat and the engineer and nuclear engineer who couldn't even pronounce nuclear, which always irritated me. But
you say that a lot of Northerners would think it was really silly if someone with a Southern accent, a thick Southern accent, read a poem out loud, a beautiful poem out loud. That kind of language doesn't work well with a Southern accent.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that it doesn't work well. I mean, it depends on what all kind of beautiful poems. I mean,
I'm kind of quoting you. I'm not making that as a statement. But you say something about that in your book that Northerners don't think that eloquent language or poetry belongs in the mouth of a Southerner.
Well, probably reading Shakespearean sonnets in a Southern accent might not be too a heavy accent of any kind might not be too appropriate. But there's certainly a lot of eloquence that sounds Southern, but I think that people tend to just say, "Oh, that's Southern," and rather than considering it as discourse or speech. I mean, people just listen to my accent sometimes instead of listening to what I have to say, which is irritating.
How has your accent changed since moving up north?
Well, I don't know. I've stopped saying things like "fangers" for "fingers." I mean, a few things I decided really sounded bad, and I wasn't going to say them anymore. But a lot of things. I mean, I still like prefer "can't" to "can't," for instance, and "poor" to "poor," because they sound. "Can't" seems to me to sound more like that word ought to sound, and "poor" sounds more like what a poor person would say. "Poor" sounds like a rich person, the way a rich person talks. So. I mean, I like a lot of the effects of Southern accents. I don't like a lot of Southern pronunciations, and have tried to jettison the ones I didn't like. But most of American popular music is sung in a Southern accent. Either everybody sings like Ray Charles or Mother Maybelle Carter, whether they're from New Jersey or where they're from. And I think that's helped to cause the Southern accent to be a sort of, people think of it as a sort of theatrical way of talking or something, or, rather than a natural way of talking. I mean, people think you're doing it on purpose or something. And I don't know, a lot of people stop talking that way. They just want to sound like a normal person, but I just figured that I would use what of it I liked and not what I didn't like. I mean, I don't like to attract, as I said, nobody wants to, for everybody just to be listening to his pronunciations and not to his sense. So, but on the other hand, I don't want to stop talking the way it feels right in my mouth.
Are there any opinions or things that you usually do that you felt you've had to hide since moving up north, things that you shouldn't expose to Northerners who wouldn't understand?
No, I mean, my opinions tend to be more Northern fashionable than Southern fashionable. I mean, and I tend to act, I mean, defend more reactionary arguments in the North than in the South, because I don't want to just, I mean, I'm a lot more interested in defending Billy Carter in the North than in the South, because I think that, you know, whereas in the South I'd be defending somebody else. I think it's really boring to say what people want you to say, and or, you know, to agree with what the established orthodoxy is. So I've tended to think of myself as more Southern since I got up in the North, for one reason, because people categorize me as Southern, and for another reason, because it seemed more interesting. And I just, being away from the South made me appreciate it more, and also made it less oppressive. I mean, I felt limited by the South when I was in it.
When Carter was elected, the town that he came from, Plains, Georgia, became a very important part of his personal mythology, because he was from a small town and he had a farm there. And now our incoming president, Reagan, is also from a small town, and he has this huge small town mythology that he's built up. But one is the Midwestern small town mythology, and the other is the Southern small town mythology. Mm-hmm. Do you have any opinions on how the two mythologies compare?
Well, I have a preference for the Southern small town mythology, because I think it's a lot more lively. I think that I think of, and it may be just prejudice on my part, but I think of, and I think Reagan reinforces this prejudice. At any rate, I think of Midwestern small town life as being more nearly smug and stiff and tight, whereas Southern small town life can be really crazy. I mean, it's you know, all sorts of wild things have gone on in Southern small towns, also in Midwestern small towns, I'm sure. But I mean, the churches are a lot louder in Southern small towns than they are in Midwestern small towns. People are kind of just tend to be heartier, and they're. I mean, Reagan said when he grew up, there was no racial problem in America. I mean, that shows how well people in small towns in the Midwest know what's going on, and people in small towns in the South may have been saying things like "our colored folks are happy," but they knew more about America than people in the Midwestern little towns, if they really believe there's no racial problems.
What do you think the country and Western music tells about small town life in the South?
Well, I think that small town, that you know, life outside of media centers tends to be in some ways more complex. I mean, life in big cities tends to get simplified down into issues, topical issues. People talk about what's going on nationally, and and things boil down into terms like Watergate, whereas in the country, things are harder to categorize. I think that you learn things less in terms of intellectual categories and in topical terms, and more in terms of just sort of harder to express awareness and familiarity with what goes on. So, and I think country music, while it's very verbal and literary, is not topical. I mean, it doesn't break things down into intellectual categories, and it sort of is sensuous. It's more sensuous.
Yeah, well, everybody's always sleeping with someone else's wife or husband and coming home drunk and talking about.
Well, that happens in the cities, too.
Right.
But, I mean, it's just the attitude. I was just talking to a radio, a very elegant man who's interviewing me for the radio over at the Athenaeum. He's taping a program, and we were talking about Billy Carter, and he was saying that how can you defend Billy Carter in light of what he did in Libya and everything? And, wasn't that wrong? And I said, yeah, well, Billy done wrong. But on the other hand, you know, sort of talking about, I mean, it seems to me Billy is a more interesting character than Billy Gate makes him seem. And this man said, but that still doesn't change the fact that it was wrong. And I said, I said, well, that's true. But what I wish I thought to say was that there's more to life than right and wrong. And I think small towns, while they are very narrow in some ways, also have more of a sense of relativity, in a sense that people can be wrong, but you still know them. You got to live with them, and therefore you get. I mean, things tend to break in the media. They tend to break up into camps and groups and factions.
Good guys and bad guys.
Good guys and bad guys. I mean, that's what's wrong with the moral majority, is that they think everything can be reduced to right and wrong, And it's not true. It's and country music, at any rate, doesn't reduce everything to right and wrong, even though there's a sort of assumption of sort of morality there. That morality is undercut. I mean, the morality is that you ought to stay with one wife all the time and not drink. But at the same time, a whole big part of the music is that people drink and run around on their spouses anyway. And so you got that combination of morality and also kind of awareness of human fallibility and universal human fallibility.
You compared a little bit small town mythology of the Midwest and of the South. Now, both Reagan and Carter also come from a strong religious faith. And again, there's some interesting comparisons, I think, to be made in terms of how they relate to their own religion and what those religious traditions are like. You said that religion in the South has always been much more boisterous. I forget the word you used.
Yeah. Loud.
Loud, right.
But, yeah, I mean, it's just been, seems to me, more hearty now. It's entirely possible. I've never been to a church in the Midwest, but I've been to churches in New England, and they're the most boring things I've ever been to. I mean, they congregate. I mean, well, I shouldn't talk about anybody's church, but, Southern religion seems to me sensuous, and there's a whole lot of eating and singing connected with it. And a whole lot of viciousness, too. There's been a lot of Southern Christians who've done terrible things, but there's almost something more interesting. I mean, I can't think of any Midwestern Christians who've done, I don't know. There's been this big racial battleground in the South where people played these sort of stark roles and did dramatic things and actually got in the streets and fought over racial matters, and the church was involved in all that, the black and the white church, it's where you didn't have that kind of thing in the Midwest. It's just a quiet. I don't know much. I shouldn't be talking about Midwestern churches because I don't know anything about it. But it just, at any rate, Midwestern culture seems quieter. Small town culture seems quieter and less dramatic and sort of more out of the hurly burly of life.
If you don't mind my asking, were you from a religious family?
Yeah, very religious, and it grated on me. I mean, I grew up in Methodist church, and loved singing the hymns and going to the suppers, but I don't go to church anymore, I still subscribe to the Judeo-Christian ethic that I learned in Sunday school, and also, I think I have a kind of, I still believe that Jesus loved the little children of the world. I mean, ironically enough, at the same time we didn't have any black people in our church, we were singing Red and Yellow, Black and White, They Are Precious in His Sight. And that still hadn't been disproved to me. And so I think there's the hypocrisy in Southern churches was interesting. I mean the ambivalence and the fact that you didn't have anybody except white people in your church, and yet you were talking about universal charity it either makes you not think at all, or if you do, just not worry about it, or if you do worry about it, it gives you kind of a complex mentality, I think. And I think Carter's mentality is a lot more complex than Reagan's. I think that there's a whole lot of the same kind of ambiguity and ambivalence that there is in country music has been in country Southern religion and in Southern culture in general, which is one reason why there's so much literature has come out of the South.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Roy Blunt, and his newest book is called Crackers. It's published by Knopf, and it's about the South and the North and the way Northerners see Southerners and Southerners Northerners. And he's also the author of the book A Few Bricks Shy of a Load, Three Bricks Shy of a Load.
Yeah.
Which is a book that he did about the Pittsburgh Steelers, first published in 1974, just published now in paperback. Getting around in your book, you said that you think the South could use a Roots of its own, like a Roots television serial that would have that would help give positive role models and a new identity to the much maligned Southern whites of America.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to try to work that out. I don't know how you would fit it into American mythology, but there would be a lot. It would have to have. It would be a sort of chastening roots rather than. I come from a heritage that can hardly figure out a way for there to be any liberation. I mean, you can't very well have cracker lib because nobody. It's hard to make an argument that anybody's been keeping crackers down except crackers themselves. And so that, and that's a strange thing. I was on a promoting my book in Memphis on television. Pat Conroy, a Southern novelist, and I were talking, and Mary Lee Saddle, who's a woman Southern novelist, was on the program too. And Pat and I were talking about how Southern white men are always on the wrong side in every liberation movement. And we, you know, we just sort of, I mean, it wasn't that we were denying that it was true. We were just saying that was our role in life. And Mary Lee Saddle spoke up and said, I'm not going to listen to that stuff anymore. How would you like to be a tall, intelligent woman in the South? I said, I'd scrunched down in so many different ways when I was growing up and everything. And we've said, well, I'm sure that's true, and, you know, it's probably our fault. And she's saying, and the trouble is that the Southern men lost the war, and ever since they've been apologizing to the women, and you got to stop doing that. And all that's left for us to say was, well, we're sorry, Mary Lee. You know, we had to apologize for apologizing all the time. But so it wouldn't be the kind of roots that would it wouldn't be kind of a liberative roots, but it might be a kind of profound roots. Where, I mean, there've been all these tacky kind of. I tell you what, Gone with the Wind probably was the Southern roots, and it had a lot of shameful stuff in it, and also, Vivian Leigh is a spirit that built Atlanta, probably the kind of mean, tenacious business person sense that doesn't have much to do with ethnicity, but. It'd be interesting to have a more, a thing that I thought maybe the Carter administration would be a sort of roots for us, but it didn't work out that way.
You're an interesting phenomenon in a way, because you're a Southerner who left the South, I think, in part because you were uncomfortable with it, and you wanted, as you say, go to the North where things were more sophisticated. And having gotten to the North, what do? You turn around and defend Southerners.
Well, I think that's a pretty common phenomenon. I mean, there's a lot of people like me. That's probably, there are a lot of Irish writers who couldn't stand to stay in Ireland, but once they get out, I think that's understandable enough. I think a lot of writers like to be not quite at home, to be, they grew up feeling out of touch. I mean, not out of touch, but not quite like everybody else, and therefore it feels reasonable enough to be living in a different part of the country. And you know, there are, I think that's not too hard to understand. And it's, I mean, the people who have responded most, with most pleasure to my book, I think, are a lot of Southern journalists around who write for Boston papers and things like that, and Philadelphia papers, and New York papers. There's a whole lot of people, writers on the staff of Eastern Northern papers.
No, I can't believe we'd stand for that.
No, we snuck in, didn't tell you, but
you describe yourself as being a frustrated singer, and you've written a lot of songs, some of which appear in Crackers. And if I may, I would like to ask you if you would sing or perhaps recite some
sure,
of your songs for us.
Sure, I'd be glad to. The one that you're not in the book, but it's real quick and easy to sing, is called "You Lied," and it goes. When you said your love would abide, you lied. When you said I'd be satisfied, you lied. When you said I messed it up. When you said your love would abide, you lied. When you said I'd be satisfied, you lied. When you said your love would abide, you lied. When you said I'd be satisfied, you lied. When you said, no, you lied. But when you said you'd hit me and knock out my tooth, you told the truth. That's it. I'm sorry, I forgot one of the four lines. But and then there's another one, which I'm sure I'll remember. He drove up in his big new car and gave a little toot in his horn, drove off with the prettiest little girl who ever was born. He's in the driver's seat now. Beside him sits my wife. I'm just a bug on the windshield of life. Now they're driving down the road and never think a thing of me. Two in the front seat's company, you know what they say about three. Now my wife looks over at him, her words cut like a knife. Old Arnie's just a bug on the windshield of life. Lord above looked down on me and said, I tell you, boy, where you are there's just misery, there is no earthly joy. You and him and your wife are all in a world of sin and strife. On down the road, I'll cleanse you from the windshield of life.
That's great. So,
Only problem with me as a singer is that I can't sing. But other than that,
you do fine.
But I can write songs.
You play guitar?
No, I don't play anything.
A few chords, you could really go far.
Well, people have told me that, and then I don't know. My wife plays a guitar, and sometimes we sit down and try to figure it out, and somehow it spoils it when it gets too musical. Country music is no more musical than it has to be.
You said it makes you laugh when you see young Northerners sitting around singing songs about boll weevils.
Yeah, well, I think that people sing folk music, country music, and rock music in southern accents as though it's some kind of sound they can do. You know, it's just like it's a sound that anybody can pick up, and it's not. I mean, those musics were written in the way that people talk, and that's why they're so good, is that they were natural expressions of the way they used the sounds of the way they talked to create the music. And I would hate for American music to get bogged down in making those same songs over and over. I'd like to hear, you know, I guess Bruce Springsteen makes the music out of the way he talks, but there's too little sense, I think, that it's an oral poetry that was put to music. It wasn't people forcing their mouths to make certain sounds, but it seems to me that a lot of current rock is sort of using those sounds and expanding on them and putting more growl into them. That sort of fake growl, and it doesn't sound like somebody talking. Original 50s rock and roll and country music sounded like the way people talked in the South.
You know, when the Beatles started becoming popular in the States, well, everyone in New York was starting to sing things with a British accent, and that kept up for a number of years.
Yeah, so of course the Beatles sang, use a lot of Southern accent themselves. I mean, they pick up a lot of stuff from Chuck Berry, and they say Kent, and they worked in some Southern stuff into their stuff, and which was all right. I mean, they came from far enough away from it, and they added, as you say, English accent to it, and sort of synthesized it in an interesting way. But a lot of people just, instead of trying to work their own accent into music and combine it with the accent of the originators of the songs, just parrot their originators of the song.
When Carter was running for office, I believe he had some country and western performers do concerts, either fundraising or just spirit-raising concerts, supportive concerts. You think that was effective for him?
Well, it seemed to work. And it seems to me that all you need to know really about the difference between Carter and Reagan is that Carter's main musical person is Willie Nelson, and Reagan's is Donny Osmond. I mean, how much more do you need to know? I don't see how anybody can vote for a Donny Osmond president over a Willie Nelson president. But I wish Carter had been seemed a little more like a real Willie Nelson fan.
You think he really was?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
there's always a chance that your public relations person says, well, the real popular person is Willie Nelson.
And that's the kind of thing that you always wondered about Carter, he let off his autobiography with quotes from Bob Dylan, Dylan Thomas, and Reinhold Niebuhr. I mean, you know, that seemed a little forced a lot of the times. And then Bob Dylan said that, I mean, it seemed forced for me, for anybody, for somebody from Georgia to be a Bob Dylan fan, for one thing, a guy of Carter's age. I mean, that didn't seem right. It sounded like something he'd sort of worked up for the occasion to make him seem more interesting and less stereotypical. That's the kind of thing that irritates me about Carter. But I think he's legitimately, I mean, supposedly Rosalind was always turning down the volume of the Willie Nelson playing in the White House. And I hear that Willie Nelson was always eating lunch with him in the White House and stuff. So I think it's not too hard to like Willie Nelson anyway. I mean, he'd been a little more ethnic if he'd liked George Jones or Loretta Lynn. But Carter just always seemed to be using whatever would confuse his image a little bit and keep people from dismissing him as a cracker. And I can sympathize with that. But I think that went to the point where you couldn't dismiss him as a cracker, you couldn't figure him out, didn't know who he was.
If I remember correctly, John Anderson wanted to have a concert with Edie Gourmet, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, you told me that. That doesn't sound quite right. I mean, it seemed like he'd be a little more pretentious than that. John Anderson is probably my least favorite political candidate.
How come?
Well, I just think, he was the virtuous. He ran on the virtue platform, and it's not as though he's been all that virtuous all his life. I mean, anybody who entertained thoughts beyond puberty of having a Christian nation, which he did, I can't forgive.
Who, if you were running for office, who would you have do concerts for you?
Well, I'd like Willie Nelson, like a little George Jones. I would want somebody who wouldn't show up, you know, because he'd be too drunk, which would be George Jones. And, you know, he'd maybe show up with a black eye or something. I'd like somebody. I did part of in the book. I hung out with Jerry Jeff Walker for a while. Who's it'd be nice to have somebody who's really sort of rough, which is the way popular musicians have tended to be. I mean, they tend real rootsy ones tend to get arrested and things. And I'd feel flattered if I had one who got arrested on the way to the White House.
That'll make for interesting headlines the next day in the newspaper.
Yeah, that's right.
You talk about Lillian Carter, the president's mother, is really playing the mother role to the hilt. I wonder how many people could have done that. I wonder if there's something about being Southern that makes that an okay situation for the president's mother to be going around the country saying the things she'd say, and to have a sister who was a faith healer.
Mm.
Now, do you think you have to be Southern to be able to have a president with a family like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how typical Miss Lillian is, but I think that I don't think that it was too. I liked the fact that he had a crazy family. I mean, he seemed like a real person. A lot of people have crazy families, and.
I'm trying to think of some of the crazier things that Miss Lillian said, and of course, nothing's coming to my mind.
Well,
right
I mean, she's. I remember. I mean, she said some really unfortunate things. She said, for instance, she met Ella Grasso in Connecticut, and said she really liked her. She wasn't fat and greasy like she expected her to be. I mean, but I mean, that's just like she was the way women talk in the beauty parlor back home. You know, I mean. It was, she just didn't censor herself, which is an amazing thing. I mean, I don't know how Southern it is not to censor yourself, I think. But the great thing about them was that they just rang true. They rang real embarrassing and sometimes offensive, but they were being themselves, all those Carters. And there was something refreshing about that. I mean, Nancy Reagan, I don't think, is going to add a whole lot to our sense of human nature by her public performances. Betty Ford was an interesting first lady because she talked about her problems and talked about her kids, and I think that's part of the role of the president's family. It's sort of an awkward role to have to play, but I'd rather have an embarrassing presidential family than a stiff one.
Where did Rosalynn Carter fit in terms of... in terms of Southern life and
well,
Southern
Rosalynn.
Stereotypes.
I thought that she was a respectable, intelligent Southern woman and reminded me of some of the women in my mother's Sunday school class. I mean, I liked the fact that she wasn't a stock figure and that she... one of the things about Carter is that... he did a lot of things that ought to be intellectually respectable. For instance, his wife was an equal partner. I mean, that's supposed to be a good thing to do these days and age, day and age, but he got in a lot of trouble for it. People didn't like it. It didn't go over. His wife's off campaigning on her own rather than standing by his side, two steps behind him. I thought there was a lot. I mean, Carter was, he's got a kind of contemporary body. He's a little guy who jogs, you know, and a lot of that was a little, I mean, that part, the fact that he jogs and seemed to me a little part of his kind of going overboard and appealing to the contemporary Eastern sensibilities. But having a real really assertive wife seemed to me a good thing about his administration. And also having, for instance, an assertive UN secretary, UN representative. I mean, Andy Young, let him talk, you know, let him say some things, and he was appealing to the third world. As far as I know, he's the first UN rep we've ever had that the third world sort of liked. But that got him in trouble, too. He had to get rid of Andy Young. I mean, Andy Young is another uncensored person. I mean, when Reagan went down to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and talked about states' rights. You know, Philadelphia, Mississippi is where they murdered civil rights workers. And Andy Young said, what that says to me is that it's going to be all right to kill niggers again in Mississippi. Now, and everybody got mad at Andy Young, not at Ronald Reagan. I mean, you know, the Carter administration, it seemed to me, except for Carter himself, had a funk and, you know, would say embarrassing but true things. Whereas Reagan's back to code words and these... you know, sort of denial of embarrassing truths.
Now, we've been spending all this time talking about regional differences and families in different parts of the country and presidents from different parts of the country. But it's easy to think sometimes that regional differences are being ironed out a little bit because of television, but also because people, particularly people like a president or a governor, tend to travel a lot and tend to be exposed not only to people from all over the country but all over the world. So the sense of a national or almost international identity develops, and you begin to perhaps lose a little bit of the distinctive qualities of your region.
Well, yeah. Well, you should, of course, lose a lot of them. But, you know, I mean, if Carter had been as Georgian as John Kennedy had been Irish, for instance, Willie Nelson, for instance, is somebody who appeals to people all over the country, and he's not Southern in a restrictive sense. I mean, he's an inclusive Southerner who likes you know, hippies and things, and is mild and not understands about things outside of the South. You know, knows that, and doesn't get his back up quick, which is an unfortunate characteristic of Southerners traditionally. I mean, Billy Carter probably got his back up too quick and decided he would just say whatever, you know, say the worst possible thing, which was sort of an interesting thing to do, but was an unwise thing to do. I mean, Willie Nelson's not like that. Willie Nelson, you know, is a hip Southerner in a kind of national and international sense. But he still sounds Southern, and he sounds real, and I mean, sounds, you know, better word than real, but I mean, he sounds like he's, you know, where he's coming from, and he's coming from where he grew up, but he's been other places too. But Carter didn't sound, and you couldn't tell where Carter was coming from, which is amazing since he was coming from Georgia. You would think that'd be one thing you could tell about a person from Georgia, but he seemed to have gone away for a period of time and come back knowing about Bob Dylan, and he didn't know what by which route he had done that.
Did you go back to Georgia much?
Yeah,
have a mother there?
My mother lives in Decatur outside Atlanta, which is where I grew up, and I go back a lot. I love to get back, and I miss, you can't get any barbecue, so far as I know, in the state of Massachusetts. I miss the food and you know, and the way people talk. When I get back there, I know how to talk in stores. I mean, I can sort of enjoy the way I talk. I mean, refer to women as ma'am and things like that. It insults people, the women in the North, if you call them ma'am. They think you're, I don't know what they think. But, I mean, I like being able to say yes'm and yes-er, you know, just to strangers, you know, to the man at the gas station. Say, yes-er, give me 10 gallons, you know. Just little notes like that feel good in my mouth. And it also feels sort of funny to me to be doing that after, you know, I mean, I didn't appreciate it when I was growing up. I mean, that's the kind of things I remember literally hearing my father, listening to the way my father talked to the man in the gas station, and thinking, well, that's the way to talk to a man in a gas station, you know, and that's the way you learn how to talk and how to deal with social situations. And my father was, you know, dealt with people real well, and or with men in gas stations anyway. But then I went up north, and you don't talk that way. I mean, you talk differently to people in gas stations. So that... you know, and I wanted to be flexible enough, so I didn't want to say something to people that they would take wrong. So unless, sometimes I do want to say things to people that they take wrong if they're, if they're not trying to I mean, I feel like I'm a lot more flexible and sensitive to the way people take things than people I talk to in the North are often. I mean, people in New York, not just people in New York, but people...
Have you been to Maine at all?
No. Well, I've been there, driven through and eaten lobster, but I haven't spent any time there.
Well, I've spent a very, very little bit of time there. But the people who I met in Maine spoke slower than people as a group that I had met anyplace else.
Mm.
And I was wondering how you'd fare or feel about a place like Maine. Since, you know, if we're making generalizations about regions, perhaps the South and Maine would be so extremely different, since Southern speech is so colorful and energetic,
yeah.
Right, and aroused, and up around the Maine area, it's so quiet and withdrawn and spacious. There's a lot of space between sentences.
Yeah, well, people in the South are supposed to talk slow. In fact, I was on the Today Show and been talking about stereotypes and everything, and then afterwards Jane Pauley said, "You talk fast." Amazing. What I had was 7 minutes to try to sell my book. Of course I talk fast. People in Maine are cold all the time, and people in the South are hot all the time. People in the South talk about being hot a whole lot, and that affects the way they talk, I think. I mean, they invent different ways to say how hot it is. It is show before God hot and things like that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Roy Blunt, and his newest book is called Crackers, and it's about people of the South and about people of the North. Roy Blunt is from Georgia and now lives in Massachusetts, but in between lived in New York for quite a while. I want to ask you about a couple of things in your book that I thought were really funny, and I thought you could just tell us about these things. One of them is New York Times for the Individual. Can you run through that for
us?
Well,
that originally a piece I wrote in the New Yorker called The Diliberto Times, and it seemed to me that the media is taking over things so much, which has to do with the South. I mean, media assumptions and everything just seems to be over mediaized to me. And it seemed to me that one logical extension would be to have the New York Times for the individual, so that, for instance, if you woke up hungover one morning, you'd open your door, and there on your doorstep would be, if your name was Diliberto, the Diliberto Times, which would have headlines saying, you know, what you did, and you might not want to read it, but you know, it would say that you proposed to a policewoman or something, and you know, and there would be editorials telling you how to run your life, which you didn't have to agree with, but you could read them, and you know, there'd be things, little stories about how you'd redecorated your apartment, and you know, there'd be reviews of what you'd done, you know, of how well you explained something to your wife the night before, you know, and and you shouldn't expect it to always be good reviews. I don't know, but there were some other media things I've forgotten. I mean, there's another thing called Quick Cut, which is, you know, people get, after movies and everything, people can't tolerate having to walk all the way down the street to get somewhere. So there's this organization, so you can just cut to where you want to be. If you want to go to a concert or something, you don't have to fumble around and go through the subway and everything. They chloroform you and carry you to where you're going, then wake you up, and there you are. And you.
Who would have the advertisements in this?
Well, that would be people whoever wanted to sell things to you. I mean, that would be a great. All people are always trying to focus in on a market, you know. That would be
the people knocking on your door in the morning.
That'd be an ultimate focusing in on a identifiable market.
You talk also in your book about seeing the village people perform. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the village people combine the worst of all possible. I mean, I had the thing about androgyny. It seemed to me that Carter is an androgynous figure, which also ought to be fashionable.
Wait. Let's start there. Why do you think Carter's androgynous?
Because he's not, I mean, compared to Reagan, for instance, Reagan's a sort of big cowboy type and who's going to keep this country strong. He's a sort of stock masculine figure. So kindly grandfatherly, but also big and Hollywood, not leading man, but at least Hollywood man type. And Carter has a kind of soft, yielding, wispy kind of quality about him. And people criticized him for that. I mean, people thought of him as not strong enough. And he's always sort of explaining things to people and interceding and trying to mediate between the Egyptians and the Jews and things like that. Instead of being this big, strong figure, he was always kind of kind of settle. I mean, the way mothers are supposed to do, trying to intercede between the kids or between the father who, you know, he never seemed like a father type or a cowboy type or any kind of conventional masculine role. He always seemed, and he was always feigning, not always feigning, but he fainted once in a road race, which is supposed to be what women do in Victorian novels, not in road races, but they faint. He was attacked by a rabbit and had to fend it off with a, you know, with a paddle in his canoe. I mean, he didn't do macho things, which is supposed to be good, you know. And he didn't start any wars. That's a great thing that people forget, is that he didn't kill anybody except 8 Americans by accident trying to save the hostages. And he allowed people to I don't know. But at any rate, and you know, and androgyny is supposed to be the coming thing, and where male and female roles are supposed to be merging and becoming less distinct and distinguishable. So I talked about that. Carter as an androgynous figure, and it seemed to me that the village people just seemed to me the worst possible form of androgyny, because they combine the brutish and the swishy. I mean, I could never understand the appeal of the village people.
Oh, okay. We just have a few minutes remaining, and perhaps in that time we should just say a few words about your other book, which just got published in paperback, which is called About 3 Bricks Shy of a Load. Now, you spent some time with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and based your book on what you found there. Now, here in Philadelphia, you know, the Phillies just won the World Series, and the other teams seem to be doing extraordinarily well this season, and all Philadelphians have been able to either feel or at least watch what it's like to have team spirit or city spirit because of sports. What kind of insights do you have into that phenomenon of identifying so strongly with this team of athletes that their win becomes your great victory, yeah, so much so that you're
well, I think it's a little bit unfortunate because the notion that you need to win something all the time is not a very good thing. That's one of the reasons people didn't like Carter. He didn't win anything, and I hope that they don't elect Reagan so we can get in a war and win that. I mean, people love to be able to honk their horn and hoot and holler, but I think it's nice if your hometown team wins, because it's nice to be able to celebrate. Of course, somebody always gets to breaks a leg in the celebration or gets arrested or something. But I don't know. Everybody, it just simplifies things to have won something. You know, our town won something. Now, it just is a simple kind of pleasure. And sports are simple. Somebody wins and somebody loses, and somebody gets knocked down and somebody doesn't. And there's an obvious appeal, physical appeal and stimulation of adrenaline to see people knocking each other down or hitting a ball and over a fence. I mean, and that's the great appeal of sports, and why I like to write about sports, is that people do physical things with their hands. And so much of American life is abstract, and you ask somebody what they do and they say, well, I'm in administration and I coordinate the AMPAC personnel department. You know, I mean, nobody knows what in the world that is, and you can never figure out what they actually do. But you ask ballplayers what they do, and they say, well, I try to knock people down. I try to take balls away from other people, you know. And then they show you their fingers where their finger. Joe Green showed me where his finger had gotten caught in somebody's jersey, and the guy or under somebody's shoulder pad, and somebody had run along dragging him along, and he weighs 260 pounds, so his finger was just turned around pretty much. I mean, people have backwards fingers and fingers that are bent double, and they have scars all over them, and there's a story about every scar. So they're a little bit like cowboys or lumberjacks or other romantic figures or soldiers and other romantic figures in American history and culture.
So the football players related to their bodies a little bit like soldiers or veterans did, showing battle scars to people who...
Yeah, sure. Their body is their instrument, like dancers. And and everything they do has something to do. I mean, they're always talking about how mental the game is, but that's that just means figuring out what to do with your body, and it's refreshing to do something with your body. I mean, to get exercise. Everybody's out running in the streets trying to do things with their body, invent ways to do things with their body, and it's nice to talk to people who just naturally do things with their body.
Do you think football players have a gift for transcending pain? Because not only are you probably going to be in pain after a game, but after you come out of a huddle, what are you going to do? You're probably going to get like 5 people piled on top of you, or you'll be piling on top of someone else, and it's from my vantage point, it looks like it's bound to hurt or potentially hurt.
Yeah, part of it is they get used to it. I mean, they've been doing it all their lives. Part of it is that adrenaline carries them through it, so they don't. I mean, they've got so much to think about, they can't. Don't have time to think about the pain. Part of it is that they heal faster than other people because they're better physical specimens or more remarkable physical specimens, and they get over injuries faster. And in some cases, it's because they're taking speed, you know, to get to, so that they don't feel things, and so they're all wired up and. And they not dwelling on how they feel, but on you know, achieving great bursts of energy. And a lot of it's, it is true grit. I mean, they really have to suck it up and do their job. But a lot of people over the age of 60 have to do that every day, and have to. And they probably ought to get more credit than they do. And they don't have as much adrenaline or as much drama and music and cheers to. Help them through it. A lot of people in pain, in you know, in every walk of life, and a lot of them are ex-football players too. I mean, they may suffer more after they stop playing. I mean, they tend to get arthritic necks and bad prostates and all kinds of complaints that linger with them. All it's an awful way to make a living.
Well, you get to be on TV a lot.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's the American dream, to be on TV. Yeah.
Well, Roy Blunt, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for speaking with us this afternoon. I've been speaking with Roy Blunt, who is a sports writer, a humorist, and he has two new books out. The first was first written in 1974, but it's just come out in paper. It's called About Three Bricks Shy of a Load, and it's about the time he spent with the Pittsburgh Steelers. And his brand new book is called Crackers, and Roy Blunt is from Georgia, so this is a book about the South and about Northerners' view of Southerners and Southerners' view of Northerners, and Jimmy Carter is a prominent character throughout the book. Crackers is published by Knopf.